Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. That is the Dies Irae from Giuseppe Verdi's Requiem. Any performance of the Requiem is deeply moving and a powerful experience. But this piece has been made even more poignant by my guest today, conductor Murray Sidlin, who's devoted the last few years of his life to this work and a powerful story surrounding it. Sidlin, the former music director of the Tulsa Philharmonic, tells the story of Raphael Schechter, a Jewish choral conductor and opera coach who was imprisoned in the Nazi concentration camp at Terezin. While there, he assembled a choir of 150, nearly all Jewish singers, and taught them the staple of the Catholic liturgy by rote, and performed it 16 times. As singers would be deported to the East, he would teach the piece again to a new group of singers. The question that comes to mind is why? That's the question that Sidlin wanted to answer, and is answered, in the multimedia piece The Defiant Requiem, which was first performed by the Signature Symphony and Chorale back in 2011. The response to the concert was so moving that they've decided to repeat the program again tomorrow evening. I spoke with Murray Sidlin back in 2011, and we feature that conversation today. Murray Sidlin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about how you first heard this story that came out of Terezin or Theresienstadt. That was the concentration camp that was sort of the show camp during the Holocaust. It was a place where a lot of artists resided, and it was sort of known, it was the place they took the Red Cross, for example. The Nazis would take the Red Cross to see.
Yes, the Red Cross did come one major visit, June 23rd, 1944. Just a little bit of exception, it wasn't designed as a show camp. It turned out that when the Nazis did the roundup of Jews in the Sudetenland and in the Czech areas, that would be Czechoslovakia at the time, they just gathered up an inordinate number of artists and scholars that by happenstance. But actually, over the years that Terezin was a concentration camp, there weren't more than two or three visits over that time. Mm-hmm. But the Nazis did brag about it. And they actually made a film called The Führer Gives a City to the Jews, a benevolent film.
Horrible propaganda film.
Terrible,
yeah.
Terrible. And they chose a very famous director at the time, a Jewish man, and they found him. They went looking for him. They found him in Holland, and he had already been in the Westerbork concentration camp there, named Kurt Geron. Now, nobody knows Kurt Geron until you see him on the screen sitting next to Marlene Dietrich in Blue Angel at the bar, the big guy. Mm-hmm. That's Kurt Geron, and he was an actor, a director, a writer, and he did his own cabaret show, traveled all over the place. He was one of these guys who did everything. So they brought him to Terezin to make a film about how wonderful life was at Terezin. So they gussied up the place, and they gave everybody suits and ties and the women jewelry and all that, and it looked like the Club Med of concentration camps. Now, interestingly enough, they abandoned the film because by the time the film was made, 1943, Nazi Germany was bombed out. I mean, it was in ruins. So if they had released the film, it would have showed that the Jews of the concentration camp were living better than the Germans in the big cities. Duh. So they abandoned the project. Anyway, how I came upon it. I was living in Minneapolis at the time. I was on the faculty of the University of Minnesota, about to go to the Oregon Symphony. And I was just walking in an area called Uptown, and it was a beautiful spring day, and there was a bookstore, Bryn Mawr bookstore, and there was a box of used books on sale out in front of the store. Oh, I've always been a sucker for those things, and I actually went over to it, reached into the pile, and I kid you not, I pulled out a book called Music at Terezin by Joseph Korosh. It wasn't a terribly good book. It was a primer. Who was in Terezin and what were they? A composer, conductor, pianist, whatever. So it was a helpful primer. But I didn't know very much about Terezin. I knew what you had just said, Rich, that this was a kind of a show place. At least that's what I thought it was. Mm-hmm. And so I opened the book to a chapter entitled Raphael Schechter. And it was just about 2.5 pages. And it just said that this was a Romanian-born, but Czech-educated opera coach, pianist, conductor, and so forth. I mean, a kind of bon vivant of all the opera dimensions. And that in Terezin, he accompanied a lot of choral music and chamber music, and he put together a chorus of 150 volunteers and taught them the Verdi Requiem by rote because there was only one piano vocal score in the camp. And they gave 16 performances of the Verdi Requiem. I couldn't believe my eyes. You know, I mean, those of us in the music world know what it takes to put the Verdi Requiem together under the very best of conditions, you know, with healthy, well-fed people and singers and orchestra, whatever it is. It's a big shoot because it's so demanding. It's difficult. It's emotionally demanding. There's a lot to learn for soloists as well as a huge chorus and all that. I couldn't believe that, first of all, anybody would want to do a Requiem Mass in a concentration camp where everybody's in prison for being Jewish. What is that all about? And so there was that question. And then secondly, how in the world, after these people would work slave labor hours of 12 hours a day, they'd make themselves go into, according to what was in the book, a dark, dank cellar where he pounded out parts for the women one night, for the men next night, the women one night, the men the next night, put it together. Then he'd get them together. Then he'd go into the next one. And everything had to be by memory because there was only one score. And that included a soloist. And 16 performances. There were just too many mysteries here. I mean, first of all, it was hard to believe. It was just incredible.
So how did you find out this story of what really happened? I mean, that's an interesting story, but how close do you think you got to the truth of what really happened?
Well, I wasn't too close then, but at least the basic outline of the facts. You know, there was a very famous rabbi named Emanuel Rose who once said, you know, in world events, the facts come out right away. The truth takes a long time. That's a wonderful statement.
Yeah.
So actually, by that time now, about a year later, I'm at the Oregon Symphony. I'm on the conducting staff there. And I was offered a position at a university there to lecture once a week, which I took. At this small college where I lectured, Pacific University, there were two Holocaust scholars on the faculty. And neither one was Jewish. One was in history, one was in English. And they had come to the Holocaust in ways that were very interesting. Both of them said, the Holocaust studies need some distance from dispassionate scholars who are not emotional about the Holocaust, but who will get at the science of it and the facts of it. And I thought that was a very wise way of looking at it. Anyway, I sat down with them. I told them what I had found. And I said, you know, what do I do? And they said, well, check all secondary sources, primary sources being people themselves, secondary sources being anything that's written. So there was a wonderful bookstore in Portland called Powell's. It's like five blocks or something like that.
I mean, it's just famous.
Enormous. And I got to know the owner, Mike Powell, and I said, can I spend a couple of days in your Holocaust section? It's probably better than most libraries. And it was enormous. So he made me sign an insurance release when I went up on the ladders, you know. Anyway, but I spent a couple of days in there and just going through anything I could to find about Terezin and looking for more information about the arts in general. Wasn't much, a little bit. Basically, I was finding the same five or six paragraphs over and over again. I went back to my buddies and I said, I'm at a loss here. He said, okay, it's time for primary sources. So I posted on a Holocaust webpage, Murray Sidlin, conductor, Portland, Oregon, searching for people who sang the Verdi Requiem in Terezin or who knew or family members of Raphael Schechter, the conductor of these performances. And I crossed my arms and just sat back watching the screen, expecting it to light up any minute with all kinds of information. 10 days later, I get a simple statement back. And it was a cryptic address, and at the end of it, it just said IL, which meant Israel. And the message simply was, what do you want them for? End of message. You know, and I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. But I thought, well, I'll come clean. And I said, I don't know. I'm just fascinated by the fact that somebody would, why, how, and so forth. Oh, this is just incredible. Okay, skip to the sidebar now. By this time, I had had this bolt of lightning, and I kid you not, this was a 4 a.m. bolt upright, one of those oh my God things where I ran down to my study, took out the Verdi Requiem, sat at my desk at 4 o'clock in the morning with English and Latin, going through it, thinking to myself, now, wait a second. What if you're not a Catholic, but you're a prisoner? What about the text then? And I began to discover all sorts of things that may have been in the mind of the conductor who put this together.
Give us an idea of what's in the text that would appeal to a prisoner.
First thing was, let's go to the end. Liber me in the Latin Mass means deliver me, O Lord. What if it meant liberate me, O Lord? And the dies irae, the day of wrath, what if this were not from God to the people who were the devotees and ordering how you would live your life, the prescription and edict for how life must be lived?
Day of the wrath for the captors.
For the Nazis. What if they were singing to the Nazis? And it says, lie with the sheep and not the goats. And it says in the Liber Scriptus, it is written and it will be avenged. And God is in charge of humanity. And if anybody fools around with that, they're going to hear from God big time. Yeah. What if all this were really what the Jewish prisoners had in mind? What if they could sing things that they couldn't say? And so I went back to my Holocaust buddies and they said, beautiful theory, prove it. You see, that's what I meant. I mean, that's why they were so wonderful, because mm-hmm. they wouldn't let you get away with a thing. One of them said to me, said, Murray, I want this to be true in the worst way, but I can't allow you to go public with this until you've got something. And you're going to have to get it the way it is now. You're going to have to get it from firsthand sources, mm-hmm. primary sources. So anyway, I wrote back to this person in Israel, and I said, here's what I'm thinking. And if it's true, Raphael Schechter is a hero. And nobody knows him. And I said, and this was absolutely true, and it's still true today, the legacy of the Nazis is assured. We know what they did. We will never forget. In fact, the Germans today, they will never forget. I mean, this was not their war, but they understand their history, and they're not proud of it. They won't forget. So that's the Nazi legacy. But the Terezin legacy is not yet known. And if there are heroes there that really need to be illuminated, we need to know who they are, because the lessons are incredible. In other words, we were beginning to see, and the Holocaust scholars are telling me, there are all kinds of ways of fighting back. You know, at the Warsaw Ghetto, they found small weapons and Molotov cocktails and all that. And they tried to hold out for a couple of weeks. And I mean, that's one way. But what if another way of fighting back is to maintain dignity and self-respect and respond to the worst of mankind with the best of mankind? What if that's another way of fighting back? I mean, in many ways, the Jews were accused by a lot of people after the war of just sort of taking it on the chin. But you see, the people of Terezin won't tell you that. They will not say that we took it on the chin. They will say, well, we fought back. Our way was to be free inside, spiritually. I mean, can I read you a short paragraph?
Sure.
There was a man in the camp named Leo Beck. He was the chief rabbi of Berlin. And when he was brought to Terezin, he became a member of what was called the Council of Jewish Elders. The Nazis put this faux council together. But at 1946, he wrote this short paragraph as a description of what the psychological state was. And this is really important, and it tells you a lot about why the legacy of Terezin must be exposed and maintained. It said, in the sheltering darkness of the long evenings, they were together in the cold and gloomy attic of a barrack, close under the roof. There they stood, pressed close to each other, to hear a talk about the Bible and the Talmud, about Plato, Aristotle, Maimonides, Descartes, Spinoza, Locke, Hume, Kant, or about the days and problems of history, about poetry and art and music, about Palestine of old and today, about the commandments, the prophets, and the messianic idea. All of these hours were hours in which a community arose out of the mass and the narrowness grew wide. They were hours of freedom. So it was the arts and humanities that gave them the spirit and, frankly, had a chemical effect on many of them. You know, the brain can fool your stomach into feeling a little bit more full when you're excited or stimulated about something that is really dramatic and good. And this is what it was. This was what they were all about.
My guest today is Murray Sidlin. He is guest conductor for the Signature Symphony as they present the Defiant Requiem, Verdi's Requiem, with multimedia featuring survivor stories, narration. It will take place this Saturday night at the Tulsa Community College Pace, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let's go back to that email. You came clean, as you said.
And I came clean, and what happened when I came clean is that there was another silence for about 10 days. Then I got an email from the niece of Raphael Schechter, this conductor, his niece, who was born in 1946, so she didn't know her uncle. But she said, my mother is his sister. My mother is interested in this and wants to know what you have in mind. She also said that her brother, my uncle, she said, may have had a friend in the camp who may be in the United States. He may be in the Boston area. She thinks his last name is Krasa, K-R-A-S-A, very common Czech name. She thinks that he may have the first initial E if he's still alive. And so I thought, okay. So I called Area 617. I was in Portland. I said, do you have a Krasa in the Boston area, initial E? Operator said, I have an Edgar in Newton, Mass. I said, I'll take it. I called the number, and the phone rang, and the answer was, hello. I thought, well, right accent, right age. And I said, Mr. Krasa, yes. Mr. Krasa, this is going to be really strange. You don't know me. My name is Murray Sidlin. I'm a conductor in Portland, Oregon. Da-da-da-da. I came across your name. I mean, Mr. Krasa, does the name Raphael Schechter mean anything to you? Long pause, and he says, well, I named my son after him. I said, Mr. Krasa, are you telling me you were in Terrazin? He says, yes. He said, I was there for 3 years, and Raphael Schechter was my bunkmate. This was on a Tuesday. Wow. I said, Mr. Krasa, if I came to Boston on Friday, may I take you to lunch? And he said, well, for a free lunch, of course. You know, so. So I can't tell you how I moved mountains to be free on that, but I went to Boston. And I met him at the hotel. I had made a reservation in the dining room. He says, no, my car is waiting out front. We're going to my house. My wife is preparing lunch. And I said, Mr. Krasa, you don't know me. I'm a serial killer. You don't want me in your house. You know? I mean, it was just like that. I mean, he embraced me, took me home. 8 hours later, I left there with the story. Huh. And the names of two other members of the chorus who I can call upon for verification or for furthering the story, and the name of another woman in Toronto who was in the audience for most of the performances, and that's how it began. That's how I was able to piece it together. I had four teachers. It was very interesting because they wanted to make sure that I was not interested in making money off of them. That was their primary concern. And once they saw that I was serious about this and that my focus was Schechter and the Verdi Requiem and how this happened and why and who and how is this possible, once they saw that that's what I was interested in, then the gates of their club clanged shut behind me and I was in, and then you don't get out after that. And these people, thank God, they're all still alive and they're still friends of mine, and I'm in touch with them all the time.
Yeah. Was it true that they were singing what they couldn't say?
The conductor, Raphael Schechter, used these words. We can sing to them what we cannot say to them. This is our way of fighting back. Those were the words. They all told me that.
What was the reaction when he proposed singing a Catholic Mass?
This is interesting. You know, you're dealing with some 60 years of memory here.
Right.
So the Holocaust scholars had a wonderful way of doing it. They said, look, ask a question, but be careful. Don't put words in their mouth because they're going to be very anxious to please you. They're going to want to say what you want to hear, but that's not good enough. You have to ask a question, a very serious, stark question, and they will probably fudge it, leave it, come back to it in 2 weeks on the phone, call, see how they're doing, and before you do it, do your Columbo. And just before you hang up and say, by the way, by the way, Edgar, was there ever any negative reaction to doing the Requiem? First few times it was, no, I don't think so. I don't remember anything like that. But about 3 months later, when I just, by the way, asked him the same question, his answer was, oh my God, shouting matches, that it had come back to him. He said that Schechter was called to the Council of Jewish Elders, and they told him, if you do this, you are going to put us all in jeopardy. First of all, it's going to stir up a ruckus of controversy among the Zionists and others in the camp who don't believe that, you know, we should be apologizing for being Jewish. And that's the way it's going to seem, number one. Number two, the Nazis will resolve the tempest simply and clearly. They will shoot you, deport the chorus, and stop all free time activities. Now, this is important. Free time activities at night. In the 3 or 4 years of Terezin, there were 2,400 lectures given by 538 prisoners on every conceivable subject. You and I can't come up with a subject that somebody didn't lecture on.
Right.
And so it was a hotbed of intellectual pursuit and over 1,000 concerts. What kind? Choral, opera scenes, chamber music, cabaret, Shakespeare recitations, things of this nature. I mean, this place was what I've come to call the accidental university. It was an astonishing place.
It was like a Kulturbund, but in Terezin.
Precisely what they would have called it, a Kulturbund. And in addition, it turns out to be one of the most active artistic centers in Europe by virtue of who was there.
In fact, there's war everywhere else.
Exactly. Yeah. And these people, they couldn't stop themselves. I mean, if they wanted to, they couldn't stop themselves. First of all, they come to Terezin, they see the people they normally associated with. So that chemistry, you know, began. Why don't we do this? Why don't we do this? I mean, completely forgetting that they're hungry and sick. The majority of them are enormously hungry. Starvation was a major issue. Disease was an extraordinary issue. And the growing weakness and the deportations. The other thing is, after the first performance of the Requiem, about two-thirds of the chorus was deported. It was not a cause and effect. It was just the draw, the luck of the draw. But with deportations come importations. So Schechter recruited and started over. Wow. It went faster this time because he had a third already trained. So that helped. So it went faster. He did this twice. There were three choruses altogether. So there was 150 in the first chorus, but about 400 singers altogether in the three choruses that he put together. That shows you how devoted he was to the Requiem. And there's something else. When he recruited to do opera scenes or a little chorus of this or chamber music, when he recruited to do that, everybody describes him the same way, a guy with a sunny disposition, a guy who was a wonderful, magnetic smile. He's a person you wanted to be association with. He was a positive force, as hungry and sick as he was. He was a positive force. But when he started work on the Requiem, two of them said to me these words. He was like a crazed man on a mission. This was different. Mm-hmm. And so we know that. We know this was different because this was political. This was highly political, and it was a way of teaching everyone how to maintain dignity. Did the Nazis get it? No, that wasn't the point. The point was not to sing it to the Nazis so that they understood it. Do you think they would have said, oh, I guess we're bad guys, we better surrender? No, they would have said, okay, subversive, right? Everybody line up, hand me my rifle.
Right.
That's what would have happened. No, they sang that for themselves, to reassure themselves of their freedom, of their dignity. It gave them courage, it gave them hope, and it stimulated them. That's why they did all of this. But the Requiem was special.
My guest today is Murray Sidlin. He will be leading the Defiant Requiem, the Verdi's Requiem, which will feature survivor statements. You've created this sort of multimedia event. Can you maybe talk about how you put this Requiem together?
Yes, it occurred to me that the Verdi Requiem needs to have a new face. It needs to have the face of Terezin. That I had two objectives. Number one, to tell Schechter's story, to give him something of the career he never had. He was sent to Auschwitz in October 16th, 1944, from which he did not return. To give him some of the career he never had. And for everyone who in the future ever hears the Verdi Requiem in concert, think of Terezin. Think of what it took. Look at these wonderful, comfortable, well-fed, happy, invigorated, healthy singers on the stage, and think of 150 Nazi entrapped prisoners of the concentration camp doing the same thing. So that was the objective. In order to tell the story, I've got video of four survivors. So between the movements, we hear testimonials about Schechter, about the life of Terezin, what it took to do the Requiem. In addition, there'll be two actors on stage who will be reciting a composite of text that I put together from various sources, and every note of the Requiem is heard. Some of the Requiem that we perform will be with piano because they didn't have an orchestra. So we draw the distinction between the reality of the piano and the ideal of the orchestra, because Schechter said about his 16 performances, all of these performances are a rehearsal for when we will do the Requiem in Prague, in freedom, in a beautiful concert hall with a grand orchestra.
Yeah, that's great. And these stories, I'm sure you had to go around and collect these stories. What an amazing experience.
Yes.
I mean, how does this affect you as a musician? Because, you know, we can always get bogged down in the mundane aspects of making music. I mean, it's got to elevate you in some way.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's a higher and grander and more noble purpose in performing than I've ever had before. I mean, I've loved going all over the world and conducting in many, many countries and participating in a Beethoven festival there and a contemporary festival there. Nothing comes close. Nothing comes close than to being in the service of the memory and spirit of those people in Terezin. It's just, you know, I can only tell you this, if I may tell one very short story. There was a woman in Jerusalem, still alive, named Edith Steiner Krauss, and she was a pianist in the camp. And I met her. She's 97 now. And I met her, and I said, "Edith, you're such an urbane musician, and you were in the audience for the Requiem many times. You knew Schechter. You knew all these people. What did the chorus sound like?" And she gave me one of those looks, you know, that was probably about 10 seconds, and it felt like a weekend, like, "You idiot." You know, she didn't say that. She just gave me that look. And she said, "You would be proud of this chorus in any urban setting, but the superficial nature of your question troubles me terribly." And so I began to do my Niagara Falls. I began to perspire like you wouldn't believe. And she said, "When you ask me a question like that, what did the chorus sound like? You're asking about all those musicianly things. I mean, did we sing in tune, precision, pronunciation, enunciation, balance, color, all those things that we always worry about as musicians?" And she said, "As if any of that mattered." She said, "We were so deeply inside the music that we had returned to Verdi's desk." And so I thought to myself, right at that moment, I have to say this, and I now admit it publicly over National Public Radio here in Tulsa. I don't think I've ever been there. With all my experience, with all my knowledge, with all my self-appraisal of my musical skills and ability, I haven't been close. We like to think that we penetrate. We like to think that we get there. But the way she put it, that we had returned to Verdi's desk, that they had transcended the limitation of the musical elements to such a degree that they got to the core of what this music is, what it means, how it got there, and how it inspired them. And I have to tell you, I don't know very many musicians who will ever say, "I've been there." I think we ride the surface compared to what they were able to accomplish musically.
It's a great ideal, though. It's something to aspire to every time you pick up the baton or pick
up
the instrument.
Now that I know I haven't been there, I know where I'm trying to go.
Yeah. Murray Sidlin, we appreciate your time. Thanks very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Conductor Murray Sidlin speaking with us back in 2011 about the Defiant Requiem. Since we spoke, there's been an award-winning documentary film which showed last week at the Circle Cinema. You can see the Defiant Requiem tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Van Treese Pace at the Tulsa Community College Southeast Campus, featuring the Signature Symphony, Crow, and Soloist, and conductor Murray Sidlin. Details at signaturesymphony.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.